So, welcome. This is part of a series that we're going to keep with the theme, Training and Wisdom. And the intent is to cover the basic core doctrines as they were taught initially and as they've been transformed by the Mahayana and the Vajrayana. These 22 Indriyas that we're discussing cover the whole ground from the beginning of the path, which is no path, which is worldly involvement totally, through the efforts on the path, wherein we get glimpses of a new perception, a new perspective, an entirely new level of consciousness. But on the path, it's only glimpses. And then the final enlightenment also has totally no attributes, and yet there are divisions in the expression of what that is. So the other way of covering the same ground is what they call the three visions. This is a Mahayana teaching. That includes the impure vision, which where we're at most of the time, where worldly people without a path are in that almost all the time. And then there's the vision of experience, which when the path is started to be implemented, begins to unfold a new way of being. And this vision of experience then has glimmers of the goal, clarity of mind, enlightenment, great compassion. We can experience all those things in the course of traveling the path, and yet we're also back in the impure vision a lot. So then the pure vision is the goal, that's enlightenment. And with the pure vision, there's total clarity, there's a total understanding and perception of things as they actually are, without any illusions or fantasies or misconceptions about reality. The word Indriya is kind of curious. It means functions or roots or dominance. And it comes from the word for the god of the second heaven, Indra. Indra was one of the main gods of the Vedic tradition. He's a lot like Zeus. He has a similar function to Zeus. He runs everything. And so by calling these things dominance, Indra, Indriya, what we're saying is that they control our entire minds from the beginning to the end. And they cover the same ground that the Eightfold Path covers, the same ground that the Six Paramitas cover. And it's part of the original teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha. Not much discussed anymore, but when I noticed the parallel between the three visions and the structure of the Indriyas, I thought it would be worth a try. Now, we're familiar with some of these things. The first five of the 13 items having to do with the impure vision, those first five are the senses, the sense organs. So these functions, these organs are the eye organ, the ear organ, the smell organ, the taste organ, and the skin, the touch organ. And then in Buddhism, there's a sixth organ, a sixth function called the thinking mind, vijnana, the dualistic mind. And this vijnana indriya is considered to be another sense. It's as if we sense a thought rather than thinking it. You know, rather than generating a thought, the thoughts are in the atmosphere and they come through us and we grab onto this thought or that thought. which is exactly why our book on Saturdays is called Don't Believe Everything You Think. Because, you know, we get thoughts from all over the place, and some of them are pretty gnarly. And then, of course, there's the PATH techniques for dealing with those. It's better not to suppress a negative thought. It's better to look at it thoroughly, even hold it in place till you see what it is. Don't react to it. Don't associate to it. Just the raw experience of the thought. And what you discover is it vanishes by itself. You know, you don't have to fight against a negative thought. Just look at it thoroughly and it'll go away without having to act on it or without getting too stressed out by the whatever situation caused that negative thought to arise. So we get non-reactive and we get a lot calmer in our lives if we approach negative emotions in that way. So we have the six indriyas, the basic sensory functions, and then of the first 13 items, the impure vision, we also have female gender and male gender, which is part of the way that our world works. So these first 13 items basically describe the way we are before we start on the path. And there's also at the end of the row, I don't know why they put it last, there's the life indriya, a life organ or life function that has influence over the arising of a sentient being and the length of life of a sentient being. So these 13 items or 14 items then describe the world that we usually live in, the samsaric world with all its woes, with all of its entanglements and all of its sufferings as well as its joys. And the next five, in fact, have to do with the emotional nature. So we're usually in one of these five states. We're in misery or pain. We're having pleasure. We have a happy mind. We have an unhappy mind. And we're indifferent to whatever it is. So those are the five basic emotions that we usually have. And we tend to bounce from one to the other in the course of a day. So I should mention that in dealing with these emotions, they're paired opposites. Happy mind, unhappy mind, pain and pleasure, and then indifference covers the rest of the ground of emotions. So the idea is to not be moved in any direction by any of those emotions. You know, simply note them. If they're good emotions, then enjoy them. If they're bad emotions, then observe them carefully and watch them go away. But to not be thrown off center by whatever feeling tones arise in our consciousness, but rather have a steady mind. That's why we try to meditate. We want to have an immovable inner core, which remains constant no matter what goes on in our lives. And this is a kind of oasis in our minds that we can go back to. And when we do practices that extends that place in the mind that we can go that's calm and stable, no matter what the turbulence of the outer world is at the time. And the more we practice this, the more calm and stable we get, the less reactive we get. So these five emotions then can be worked on during the vision of experience, during the effort to apply the path. One of the ways to look at the impure vision, one of the ways to pick it apart and to see what it is what they call the four thoughts that turn the mind to the Dharma. So we're in the world and we notice there's a lot of suffering. You know, there's a suffering of birth, old age, sickness, and death. Those are the universal sufferings. There's the suffering of not getting what you want, of not being able to hold on to what you do want, of getting what you don't want, and other similar sufferings that we have in the course of the unfolding of our lives. So to note that, to deeply look into that suffering, and to understand that that's part of our human condition. Then there's the law of cause and effect, where we begin to realize that what goes around comes around, that we, if we extend happiness and joy to the outer world, we receive happiness and joy from the outer world. If we give the outer world a bad time, we're going to get a bad time in return. So that's, in a nutshell, the law of karmic cause and effect. And of course, there's also the cause and effect of physics, which we're subject to. You know, we're all under gravity right now. In fact, if we weren't, we would float away. So gravity is a useful feature of our existence. Then the other thing to notice about the impure vision, about the samsaric life, is that everything is impermanent. This is disconcerting for us, because we prefer permanence. We prefer things that we like to remain as they are, and nothing remains as it is. Everything changes. It changes constantly, and in all kinds of ways. Our minds change, our lives change. And in the old days, when things were the same generation in and generation out, the changes were very slow. And the grandparents had similar experiences to what the grandchildren experienced. So there was a kind of stability, and it seemed like the world was going to remain the same. The changes were hard to perceive at the time that this impermanence was stressed by the by Shakyamuni Buddha. Now the impermanence is obvious to everybody because things have speeded up. And our children and grandchildren don't have the same experience that we had growing up, because they're growing up into a different world. So they have a different cast of mind, different concerns. And there's a lot of disconnect between the older people and the younger people, because we're living in different worlds. And unfortunately, the older we get, the more we live in the past, which is not necessarily a good thing. But we, I'm totally retro now. I don't have a cell phone. I barely use the web. I don't have Facebook. I don't want it. I realize that a lot of people, even my age in the 70s, will use those machines a lot. And I use them only in a minimal way because I think somebody's got to remain unwired. It's like in the old days when the alphabet came in, it was a major innovation. And some people purposely remained illiterate so their memories wouldn't go away. Because the criticism was, well, if you write it down, you won't remember it. And now you write it into a computer file and really don't remember it. And then, you know, if you have to remember it, you need to look it up on the web. This is not a good situation. It'd be nice to have memories like the Tibetans have, which are extensive. They can quote reams of text from memory. It's amazing. We've lost all that, and we lost it in like 600 BC or so. But life goes on and things change. It's never remaining the same. And we deal with whatever whatever media we have to deal with. And, you know, if you want to go Luddite and say wreck all the machines, how far back do you want to go erasing technology? You want to go to the agrarian Middle Ages? You want to go to the Paleolithic where we're you know, hunting animals with stone arrows? I mean, that makes perfect sense. It's a good lifestyle. But do you want to do without fire? You know, initially human beings had no fire. That's a technology. So the question of technology is a vexed question because it's totally unclear where appropriate technology ends and totally inappropriate or destructive technology begins. Now, all of that is under the rubric of the impermanence of life as we know it. Then that's kind of grim. There's sorrow and misery. There's impermanence, which is not good for us. And there's also the fact that we're bound by the laws of karma. But there's also some good news, and that's that this human life is totally precious. And the reason they say it's precious, the reason we can experience it as precious, is for one thing, it's good to be alive. You know, we sense that every once in a while, how deeply excellent it is to be a living being. And the other thing is, as human beings, we're totally auspiciously positioned to practice the path. If we were in the lower realms, we're too busy being miserable. In hellish circumstances, there's no connection with the Dharma and no possibility of Dharmic practice because it's too hectic. If we're in the heaven worlds, then life is too cushy. We're too busy enjoying the fruits of our good karma until we wear it out. But so Dharma practice tends to get a back burner kind of approach. You know, the people in the heavens apparently can practice if they choose to, but they're too busy having fun. So in the human realm, it's that we suffer enough that we're driven to do something about it, and yet we have the leisure and opportunity to practice the Dharma. So they say only from a human incarnation can you achieve enlightenment, that the gods pretty much go to the celestial realms with whatever they've got, and when they've used up the heaven karma, then they fall back into one of the lower worlds. So there's little progress, little spiritual progress made in the heaven worlds. But on the earthly world, a lot of spiritual progress is in fact possible. And that gets us to the vision of experience, the practice of the path. And to practice the path, of course, we need some wisdom as well as some mindfulness, as well as some concentration. And we need ethical behavior. Because if we don't have ethical behavior, we're going to cause ourselves problems. You know, because the feedback from a negative action is going to invariably descend on us. So the more ethical we are, the better our lives are. That's just part of the way the world works. So assumed in all this is that we gradually improve our ethical standing. You know, whatever level we're at, we want to make it better rather than worse. So you have those things on the path, then. You have the ethics, the mindfulness and concentration, and the wisdom. And you need the wisdom to know what you're doing. They say, if you have all wisdom and no compassion, then you're cold and distant like the top of a mountain. It may be very lofty, but it's cold. And if you have only compassion and no wisdom, then you end up being a stupid saint and are not effective in the activity of helping other sentient beings achieve their fullness as well. So there's various ways to look at the path as a process. This is on the yonder path. I'll just read this handout. The vision of experience transforms the ordinary samsaric perspective. We now see that things are impermanent and transient, devoid of any inherent nature of their own, and lacking in purity. So beginning to see that is the beginning of the vision of experience, that, oh, that's where we are. Things don't have any substantial existence because they keep changing. One thing changes into another. Nothing is constant. Now, in this system of the 22 Indriyas, they designate the path as these five roots, the five Indriyas: faith, vigor, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And those cover the same ground as the Eightfold Path or the Six Paramitas. It's the kind of efforts that we need to make in order to transform our minds and our hearts to become not only better people, but more effective, compassionate people. We've encountered these before. The 37 wings of enlightenment include the five roots. And it's said when they're no longer plagued by their opposites, we can have faith, and then there's doubt comes up. You know, we can have vigor and effort, and then laziness comes up. But once these five are without their opposites, they're complete, then they're called the five powers. Because, of course, when you have a concentrated mind that way, that has no opposite negatives, then it's very powerful. I'll get back to that. But I want to talk about the pure vision. And I'll read that too. This is a quote, this is a paraphrase coming out of Desheng Rinpoche's book, which is about the three visions. And this book about the three visions covers the entire doctrine from the realm of the six worlds of samsara all the way up through enlightenment and some topics in Vajrayana as well. So he says, the final or pure vision occurs when the practitioner has attained spiritual liberation, that is Buddhahood. At this point, the vision is no longer obscured by emotive habits such as attachment and aversion, or the ignorance that proceeds from a mistaken belief in subject and object. This direct perception of things as they are is called the non-duality of clarity and emptiness. So luminous emptiness is what the direct perception that's sought is about. And we may have had glimmers of this. I remember every once in a while during conversations with people, the white light will descend on us and we'll be enveloped in white light. This happens in AA meetings sometimes and happens in good conversations sometimes. So that luminous emptiness is part of our repertoire. It exists in us. And the more we can clear up the obscurations and the negative emotions, the more clearly that wisdom light can shine through. So non-duality of clarity and emptiness is one of the features of liberation. And indeed, of the Indriyas, the 19th to the 21st items on that list belong to the pure vision. Will to know the unknown, what is unknown, and possessing all-knowingness or omniscience. You notice that's a curious way to divide it up. The will to know the unknown, and then the second item is what is unknown, and the third item is possessing omniscience or all-knowingness. So that in the version of the Indriyas summarizes what nirvana is. It's unknown, and yet it's possible to know it through following the path. I hope I can remember this. I read up on the five roots, and it's kind of complicated. If you start with faith, it's rarely mentioned in Buddhist writing except briefly, but it's totally assumed. You can't get anywhere without some faith. It's just that in Buddhism, the faith is contingent on direct perception. You say, okay, I'm going to accept this as probably true. I'm going to believe it. But until I know it to be true, until I have direct experience of it, it's just a belief. It's not a matter of faith. It's a mere belief. And we then accept the confidence in the Dharma that we get from perceiving the results, from perceiving, oh yeah, that's really true. I never thought about that, but it's true. So as we have those experiences, as we investigate the Dharma skeptically, then we begin to have confidence that it's true. So those things we don't know about, such as reincarnation, maybe so, maybe not, put it on the shelf, you know, accept it tentatively as a possible belief. And then when you get to Buddhahood, you'll actually perceive your previous lives. So then there's no question. Then it's a matter of direct experience. But it's a little different from the Christian faith, though it has a lot of similarities. With the Christian faith, you're expected to believe it totally without having directly experienced it. And many Christians have forgotten the possibility of directly experiencing these things. You know, they merely have belief structures, and if they're very dualistic minded, they can become fundamentalist and bigoted. There are semi-fundamentalist Buddhists out there. Some of them are on the websites where it just has to be just so. You know, this involvement with the rule book, this identification and attachment to the rule book. So we want to avoid that kind of faith. We want the real thing. And there does exist a kind of thing that's pure faith. That's the one that is talked about in the New Testament, the faith the size of a mustard seed will move mountains. That's pure faith. And mustard seed, by the way, is a very tiny, spherical, BB-shaped seed. And you plant it, and this mustard seed is going to grow into a huge plant. And likewise, that tiny amount of pure faith, when planted in the mind stream, will grow into an incredible structure. So we start by investigating the Dharma and see if we think that it's true, if by our experience it's right. There's a saying in Tibetan, be like the goldsmith that grinds and tests the gold to see if it's genuine. And in a similar way, treat the Buddha's words. Verify them for yourself. Do skeptical inquiry. And if it turns out to be true for you, then follow it, or try to follow it. In the case of some of the features of the path, they can be a little hard to follow. Like, we want constant mindfulness if we can get it. Nobody I know for sure has constant mindfulness. And in fact, if we experiment with mindfulness during our day, we begin to notice we spend a lot of time on automatic pilot. You know, I'm amazed. Did I lock that door or not? Well, I don't remember locking that door. You know, so I have to go back and make sure I locked it. Did I go into a room? What did I come in here for? I've forgotten. You know, all kinds of unmindful action occurs during the day. And then we get these little moments of mindful awareness. And they're kind of wonderful, so more of that, please. But then that necessitates sitting on the cushion, having a constant meditation practice of some sort, even 10 minutes a day. Just set aside, detach from the external world, and let the mind settle. Follow the breath, that's our usual technique. So what the mindfulness does, what the meditation does, is increase the level of mindfulness that you get throughout the day. So you spend less time on automatic pilot. Lately I've been noticing the radio. I listen to a lot of classical music on the radio. And I'll miss the designation of what piece of music that was because I wasn't paying enough attention. You know, that's an unmindful moment. I missed that because I wasn't paying attention. You know, we need to use mindfulness to direct our attention where we want it to be. And when we experiment with doing that, then we discover that the attention is going to vacillate and wander. And so we want to increase our attention span. And the only way to do that is to work with mindfulness, to work with meditation. Gradually the mind starts to stay where we put it, but it doesn't stay anywhere for very long, ordinarily, unless you really concentrate on something. And then when it comes to attention, you need to consider there's two ways to approach attention. If your attention is taken by something, even something good, a beautiful painting, it's like you have no mindful gap between the involvement with the painting and the experiencing of the painting. So we want to have directed attention where we intentionally focus our attention on something and try to hold it there, rather than let the things in the world take our attention away from us and draw us into some external, usually questionable activity or image. If you watch TV, there's a lot of nasty stuff on TV anymore. And we don't necessarily want to put that in our minds. You know, we want to take an occasional news fast, you know, not to be subjected to this constant reportage of mayhem. You know, there's plenty of mayhem in the world we don't need to consider at all as related to our daily lives. You know, you can't stop caring, can't stop having compassion, but effectively, there's not very much that we can do about these large-scale problems. You know, it's better to concentrate on our small-scale world and make that right. You know, it's a matter of shaping up and flying right, so to speak, so that we're more in tune with our inner core, and our inner core then directs us in terms of what we can do and what we probably better not be involved in. So I'm not buying a gun, even though a lot of people are. Yeah, we'll just take our chances of the world as we have it. So anyway, faith, a good thing to have a lot of. Unfortunately, the fundamentalists and bigots have kind of co-opted that word. And it's actually for everybody, and we need to resuscitate some of those words that have been co-opted in superficial and negative ways. You know, you don't use your faith as an excuse to oppress other sentient beings, which has been a constant misuse of faith through the millennia on the part of some beings. Because the vision of experience is for imperfect beings. You know, we necessarily try things, and sometimes we succeed in being mindful and being actually objectively helpful to people, and sometimes we don't. So there's no perfection in the path until we perfect each item. So as I said, if you get perfect faith, you have pure faith, there's no object. It just is. And likewise with effort. Now, some of these items are useful in our worldly activity, and certainly vigorousness is a virtue. You know, it makes us more effective people. But here, the word virya means vigor and effort, but it refers specifically to the efforts to practice the path. In other words, if I do a compassion exercise, and I apologize, I forgot to open with the four immeasurables. We open with a refuge and bodhicitta, as they call it, and close with a dedication. Making the effort, I'll enunciate what they call the four immeasurables. It's that may all beings, including my friends, enemies, and people that are strangers, may all beings, including animals, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings have the joy that is beyond suffering. May all beings rest in equanimity, free from attachment and hatred. And saying a thing like that, beginning a Dharma activity, is a useful for raising the consciousness up where we can reach some of these ideas and some of these practices. So that's why we do that at the beginning. So we have the effort. Any practice we do requires that we set aside whatever else we're doing and concentrate our effort on the practice. But it needn't be strenuous effort, at first at least, it needs to be effort pointing our minds towards the path rather than towards the world. And then the effort consists in, when it reverts back to the impure vision, to gently bring it back to the vision of the path. And this process goes on a long time, but we get better at it. So our effort becomes more full. Our faith becomes more full. And these last three, oddly enough, they're also in the Eightfold Path and the Six Paramitas, and they're very key fundamental items in the repertoire, and that's mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Mindfulness is something everybody needs. In fact, it's already invading the secular world, as well it should. There's mindfulness done with people that are locked up in prisons, for instance. And mindfulness taught to people that are addicted to some substance or some other thing. And it's useful for people in various kinds of misery because it helps them relieve that suffering, relieve that stress, and replace it with a positive mind, at least for a moment. Mindfulness can be taken out of the religious spiritual context and put into a secular context, and it's still highly useful and valuable to people. So the mindfulness movement, as it gains ground, is very beneficial for ordinary people who may this lifetime not be involved with any kind of spiritual path. There's a lot of people out there that, for one reason or another, they're not attracted to the path, they don't need the path in the current incarnation, or they need it and they're not aware that it exists. That's the sad thing. You know, a lot of people are desperate for something, you know, something that will alleviate their suffering. But they don't know that there's a real path with real liberation at the end of it. And that's unfortunate. That's what makes us very fortunate beings, in that we've discovered that that exists and that we can follow it to an increasingly large extent. So mindfulness for everybody. Concentration, used as a spiritual tool, is essential. In a worldly sense, concentration is also pretty useful. If you're a craftsman, you have to really concentrate on the on whatever you're working on, whatever medium you're working in. You have to have focus. And concentration is really nothing more than one-pointed focus. You know, deep focus. And the concentration that we get in meditation is beneficial. There's also negative concentration if you're in a negative mind. Like if you're going to be a safecracker, you really have to have a lot of concentration. You know, you have to be able to hear every click in that machine in order to get the ready safe open. That doesn't mean it's meritorious activity. But used as a spiritual tool, concentration is really a key necessity. There are four levels of concentration and four what are called formless concentrations. The kind of mindfulness meditation that we do is on the beginning edge of the concentration world. And we eventually get what's called access concentration. And once we have access concentration, then we're ready to enter what they call the first dhyana, which is a level of deep trance. Now, this is not a hypnotic trance. This is alert and awake trance, but it still has some of the qualities of trance. It's a very, very focused mind. And during the first dhyana, you have a certain amount of joy, inexplicable joy, being in that state. It's a very positive state. It's a state that resonates with the heaven world of the creator, Brahma. So it's joyful, and it still contains a lot of thinking, consideration. You just think about positive things. As you go through into the deeper dhyanas, there's one where the beings in that state communicate not with words but with syllables of light. And then the third dhyana involves total purity in every aspect, in the mind, speech, and body. And then the fourth dhyana, the fourth level of concentration, is where the fruits of the spiritual life begin to manifest and people become arhats or advanced bodhisattvas. So that level of concentration is available. But for our purpose, since we're working on our minds, trying to clear up the cloudiness of the mind, trying to clear up the turbulence of the mind and the negativity of the mind, it's better to stay at the level of mindfulness and light trance. You know, for ordinary life, we don't need the deep levels of concentration. This is something you do when you go off and live in a cave, or when you meditate 4, 5, 6 hours a day. Then you can get into these states of concentration. For our purpose, a 10-minute meditation, better yet, a 20-minute or half-hour meditation, is enough to settle the mind and to create a platform where we can work on our stuff. So these deeper levels of concentration are for people that have already cleared up their therapeutic needs. And most of us need to work on our neuroses with mindfulness before we need to go deeply into the concentrated world. And then, let's see, so we have these five roots. The fifth one is wisdom. And as I say, it's complete, it becomes a power. When there's nothing but mindfulness, imagine that constant mindfulness all day. You know what your body is doing, you're aware of the present moment, you're aware of your presence in the present moment, and that's 24/7. That seems impossible to us at our level, but they say that it is possible. At least in some mysterious way it's possible. So, likewise, the wisdom, if it's complete, is ultimate wisdom. Again, we have to start at the beginning where we are. You know, you have to pass through kindergarten before you can get to the first grade. Have to pass through the first grade before you can get to the second grade. And in the case of wisdom, you start out with worldly wisdom, knowing how things work in the world. A lot of worldly wisdom seems like nonsense to the spiritual world, and spiritual wisdom seems like nonsense to the world. You know, the idea of, for instance, when you have a dispute, actually giving away the victory to the other party. You know, that's one of the practices in mind training. It's rather hard to do, but when you're in a low-level confrontation, it defuses the confrontation entirely. To say, okay, you won that point. Even if they're speaking nonsense, if you defuse the negative impact of the interaction, then something positive takes its place, and things are better for you and for the other person. There are other times, of course, when you need to claim the victory. That's a matter of the skillful means. None of this stuff is 100%. It has to be applied in a wise manner. So increasing the wisdom is then a good thing. And this level of wisdom, I'm calling this series Training in Wisdom, but we're focusing on the core ideas because we have to get the foundation straight. You know, you can't build a house or a temple on a shaky foundation. So the beginning of all these things is the foundation. And then as we get farther into each item of the path, then it becomes solid for us. And pretty soon we're living in the Dharma rather than living in the world. And that is a good thing in spite of the fact that it entails a little bit of isolation from people, people that are not practicing a path. not total. And you find there's a lot of very positive people that simply have no need. I'm reminded of Tom Bombadil in the Lord of the Rings novels. He was completely beyond the battle of good and evil. He just had fun. You know, and he was obviously very cordial to the seekers that showed up in his realm, but he was not involving himself in the great battle between good and evil. He was done with that. He was done with that duality. So there's a level where the struggle ceases. And if we let go of the struggle, drop the story, and continue in our quest for wisdom, and then drop the quest too, then the enlightenment naturally emerges. But these things have to be done in a proper order. We have a lot of people that have dropped the quest before going on it, or not even know there's such a thing as a quest. So this is something for the later stages in our, but effortless, they keep saying that, and I keep wondering, do I believe that? Because it seems to be, it takes a lot of effort to work the Dharma. But they keep saying that the final fruition is totally effortless. So I'll accept that on the shelf as maybe it's so and maybe it's not. I haven't experienced effortless very much. So we want to perfect all these things. And with wisdom, it's the items of the Dharma which you can mindfully review. That's why it's advisable to memorize, like the Eightfold Path, for instance. Suffering, cause of suffering as negative action, the fact that release from suffering is possible, liberation is possible, and then the Eightfold Path or the path that you tread in order to be released from suffering. So that's very, very basic, but going through those in the mind entails having to have memorized them. So when I studied Chinese Buddhism, I got Ku Ji Mie Dao. And that's the suffering, the arising of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path in four words. And then I can pick it apart. What's Ku? You know, and so for me, learning some of those terms in Sanskrit is very useful because it gives me a peg to hang it on that doesn't have a lot of connotations in English. In any case, a certain amount of memorization is necessary because we want to be able to review those things in our minds. We're, you know, taking a walk in the woods and it's beautiful and we think about the Dharma and then we maybe review what the four thoughts are. But in order to do that, we have to remember them. And my experience with memorizing these lists is you can get three out of four pretty easily. But what was that fourth one? So, you know, you have to work it a little bit. But these five, faith, vigor, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, you can consider them in great detail if you remember them, what they are. To review, faith, it, as an intellectual effort, is what it says again in the New Testament. It's the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. In other words, you're taking an intellectual chance. You're going to believe something you don't know to be true. So that takes a leap of the intellect to, well, I'm going to believe this because it seems to be true. I'm told that it's true, but I need to investigate further. But I'll tentatively believe it. That's the intellectual version of faith. Then there's the volitional version of faith. I will do this. I will believe this. I'll put my will behind that belief until it becomes a matter of direct perception. So that takes that's an effort of faith. And then there's social faith. Just following the basic rule book of ethics is faith in the societal action of ethical behavior. But soon we have a direct perception. Wow, I send out joy and and confidence in life, and that's what I get back from people. It's amazing. It works works wonders to transform your expression in that way. It's well worth working, rather than get set off by something that usually makes you mad. Look at the anger and let it dissolve, and realize that it's only just energy, and this energy can be used for many purposes, other than attacking somebody verbally or even physically, though a lot of that goes on, or mentally. Again, of these three, body, speech, and mind, it's easier to have ethical behavior of body. And then later we learn to watch our tongues. And, my motto there is don't make it worse. By saying the wrong thing, by saying exactly the wrong thing in some cases. So we gradually restrain our speech. And then the mind is the last and hardest one, because you're going to think stuff that you don't say. And to be in a positive space all the time seems impossible. That's so far down the road that it might as well be impossible.
Bob, to know the, with the mind, I it's definitely harder with that. But that, if you look at it like you said, with that it's just energy, it dissipates faster.
Yes. The thoughts will dissipate faster when you look at them as just energy. And, especially the affect-laden thoughts, the emotions. And if you have a strong emotion, it's going to take longer to disperse it. And sometimes you have to restrain yourself and put all your effort into not saying or doing something that you regret later. But in other cases, especially with small irritations, or sometimes I'm alone and I have a series of memories and all of a sudden I get enraged by whatever happened in the distant past. And in that case, I go to a mirror and just look at my face with all that anger and feel the adrenaline going through the bloodstream. And is that a good state to be in? Is that a happy state to be in? Not hardly. But, as we gradually work with these things, they gradually begin to dissolve, and we put in a habit of doing the right thing, habit of saying the right thing. And gradually things improve. It's amazing that our lives are a reflection of our minds. And as we work on our minds, our lives are going to get better.
With regard, Bob, to the distant experience and emotion attached to some of those experiences,
distant experience?
Yeah, when you said that sometimes you find yourself having a memory.
Oh, yeah.
Having an emotion with regard to the memory.
Yes.
And maybe the emotion is a negative, very negative emotion. I often wonder about the wisdom of saying to oneself, because an experience in the past might be a recurring experience.
Yeah.
Recurring.
These things recur, yes.
And so then this experience, say that's more recent, is almost identical to a whole string of experiences.
Yes.
Coming from the same place over time. So, so I asked myself about if there is any wisdom in following that poem or saying, it was very popular a few years ago, that you walk down the street, you fall in the hole.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So then finally you say, I'm not going to do that, but you find yourself back in the hole. And then you do this again and again, and then finally you're just not going to walk down that street.
Or you're going to walk around the hole.
Because you've tried
rather
walking
than falling
around the
in
hole,
it.
Whatever.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are other people who have better memory of that particular sequence of how it goes. I just remember that at the end, the person that's narrating this poem or such says, I'm not walking down that street.
Yeah.
So I wonder about the wisdom of saying, I'm going to change that part so that this that has been so recurring just can't, it's like I'm going to pull that weed out.
Yeah. And the thing you want to do in the case of recurring negativity is work on it. Sometimes it takes a long time.
Yeah.
And one of the unfortunate things that happens in temples and monasteries is you get into a retreat situation and the mind settles. And those things don't come up nearly so often because the triggers for them are no longer readily available. But you got to dig out the very root,
yes,
because otherwise you go out back in the world and all that stuff regrows and then you got to start again. So it's very important to get to the nitty-gritty hardcore of whatever's bugging you and root that out. And this takes a lot of work. The principle is, well, there's two things. You don't want to dwell in the memory.
Right.
You want to be in present moment as much as possible. No fantasizing about the future, or to a less extent as possible. And likewise, no dwelling on the past, no attachment to the past. That's the goal. That's the ideal. So if you're in the present moment and a memory comes up, then you're really dealing with the emotion of the present. And it's the attachment to that past event that causes you to go back in memory to it. And it could be a positive experience. In that case, you enjoy it in the present moment. I remember that. That was sweet. But the main thing is to stay in the present and deal with whatever comes up. And then eventually get the very root of these negativities out of the mind stream. That's called purifying the mind stream, and we need to work on that a long time before we're ready to make the leap. If we worked on it enough, maybe we're ready to make the leap. You know, in realize emptiness rather than theorize about it.
So in the suggestion of, in what you're saying, of purifying the mind stream, the value and the wisdom of perhaps making an effort to find a situation that allows for more effort on purifying the mind stream, because so many of us are just constantly dealing with the same thing over and over and over.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So
yeah.
Then finding, maybe trying to find that place where one can take a better look without having to always be challenged similarly all the time. Does that make
yeah.
any sense?
Yeah, that's why we go on retreat.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, we go on retreat in order to let these things settle out. And unfortunately, with a short retreat, if you haven't got to the core of it, you'll get your afflictions back. But at least you've had 3 days where the afflictions have gone away momentarily. And eventually the roots are dug out. That's why we have these five indriyas that constitute the path are called roots, because it's planting positive roots so that what grows instead of a series of negative thoughts is a series of positive mind states. And to do that, we need to let things settle. And we need to work on our minds. It's like cultivating the soil. You know, the seed is the Dharma, and then the water and the sunlight are the auspicious conditions surrounding the practice of the Dharma. And we need all of those conditions in order to get the positive seed to grow. And then once it does, then eventually you get the fruition, which is the liberation from suffering that we see.
So, Paul, you also said that there were exceptions to this, and one of the things that's happening right now is that there are some very terrible things being said. And so the conflict that I'm coming to is that when I come upon that and then try to use that system, what if in the case that is that, so say that there's the trigger, whatever this person says, and there's you.
So there's also that feeling, like, for example, when you said give them the win on the conversation or something like that, but what if sometimes people give the person the win because they're not going to confront someone who, right now there's a lot of meanness and pushback.
Yeah,
so that
public meanness.
Yes, and so if someone says something really bad, people, I think, are frightened to confront it because of the verbal attack that happens. But so when you get to that type of thing, it seems like there's a situation where you need to stand your ground.
Yes.
And not give a conversation. If you feel
don't
like
give away the store.
Don't forget. Something that you totally, and that gets to be problematic when the thing like you're talking about might be a real wrong, and wrongs can go on for a very long time, and then wrongs will happen over and over
again.
So that's where it gets really tricky for me. And even this morning we had a situation where, so it was really great we're coming here today, where I haven't been, you know, getting upset a lot, but then something totally mean had happened, totally unnecessary from a person who's pretty intelligent, and you know, and so then that's where we're in the conflict now, is that if I gave the point, I would feel terrible. I would be saying to that person, you're right, and it's totally not right. If I, there I go, and then it was causing a lot of, so there,
yeah.
I'm putting that one
well
out.
Well, that's why the wisdom, why the wisdom piece is there. Because you have to know when to apply those antidotes and when you need a different approach entirely. And, you know, if you take it literally and say, okay, every time I'm in a conflict, I'm going to give away the victory, that's not going to work. But there's certain other situations where that's exactly what to do. You know, even if you think you're right.
And what in the cases where we don't, well, I mean, no one ever knows they're right, but what if we know that that's wrong and hurtful? What is the strategy there?
Well, there are several things you can confront but not attack. You can simply assert that no, that's wrong. That's not good behavior.
Kindness matters.
Kindness matters.
Something like that. Just I've done that before. Just kindness matters.
Yes.
Then it's in their court.
And
they know.
And the thing that we tend to do that makes it worse is when somebody expresses all kinds of negativity, then we disrespect them.
Yes.
And, you know, that's a mistake. We have to have deep respect for all sentient beings. That doesn't mean that we can approve of what they do, necessarily. It doesn't mean that we may not have to take some kind of action in response to what they do. But to have that inner respect for all beings diffuses a lot of situations, because people make trouble when they feel they're being ignored, you know, or being slighted in some way.
And it's their story.
Yes,
it's
and you don't
story.
Buy into their story.
Yeah.
But by the same token, you're respect them as full sentient beings. They may be misguided. They may be doing, sadly, things that are going to reap some bitter suffering in the future. But it's their story.
It's their story.
And if you buy into their story and get in an outright battle, then, you know, you've wasted your energy and you've not helped the situation at all.
And it's energy.
Yeah. Yeah, and conversely, if someone attacks you, you defend yourself ordinarily.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to just add here, because I'm comfortable with you. I have the saying that Jamyan once said to me, you have great equanimity.
Ah.
But here's how I've added to that. It may be that in these situations there's great equanimity, but when it comes to my kids, shut down.
Yeah, that's the irony.
Yeah.
How is it the people we're closest to are the ones we have the most difficulty with?
Because
you get into these
principles. I do try to remind myself of this, and I try to hold it close. And I believe that things are just getting better and better in terms of our complex relationships, and I'm very grateful to having Nalanda to come to Jiangyang's talks and the teachings. Like one Buddhist teacher said, I've studied the many religions of the world, and I believe that we have, us Buddhists have very good tools for other people. So I'm gonna reach into the tool chest. So for me, it's really the big question happens to be with just a relationship with three other people that happen to be my children, and it gets so complex that sometimes, and I even genuinely believe that since exploring the Dharma and the Dharma teachings and trying to develop some of these tools of mindfulness and such, that now it's become like a challenge to them to see if they can knock me off kilter.
Oh, yeah. Well,
you know what I said?
Yeah, the people that give you trouble are your best teachers,
well,
unfortunately.
I told myself that, but I'm ready to move to New Zealand.
Well,
so,
thank you very much. I think what we can do is take a break and have a munchie or two.
Yeah.
And I'm going to turn off this gadget.